Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Plus, terms and conditions apply.
Now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
One late afternoon in 1950, a mushroom hunter finds a body of a woman off a little used road in West Virginia. It is clear she was murdered and dumped in this remote location. Despite there being few clues to her identity, investigators get to work trying to identify her and her killer. Within the first year of discovering her body, investigators claim to have identified her 7 different times. None were correct. Now, almost 75 years later, the woman's name and her killer are still unknown. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, it's been a while since we talked about an unidentified woman, and that is negligence on my part.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. Mm-hmm. So today we're going to share the story of a woman who is often referred to as Morgan County Jane Doe, and sometimes as Bath Jane Doe, and sometimes referred to as the Redhead murder case. So the story of her discovery and the attempts to identify her, it does get a bit convoluted at times, but I think it really does illustrate, and her story illustrates how much people wanted her identified and how much they wanted to just like close this case. Now, during my research into her case, I learned that she was connected to a lot of other cases of violence against women and other missing persons cases. And I'm not going to get heavily detailed into each of those because I want to keep the focus on Morgan County Jane Doe and the attempts to identify her. But this week on my newsletter, Girl Hunt, I'll share more.
Awesome. So can you just remind our listeners where they can find Girl Hunt?
All right. That's a great question. So Girl Hunt is my weekly newsletter about true crime, dealing with women. It releases every Friday. And it means you can get stories like this delivered like right to your inbox. You can find it on Substack, but you can also go directly there by heading to girlhuntmedia.com. Or you can go to our socials, and it's linked off of there in our links.
So I wanted to bring something up.
Yes.
To our listeners. So we are still really trying hard to grow She Goes By Jane, as you know.
Yes.
Because this is a topic of conversation you and I have been having for a long time. And I think that our listeners can help us out by going to our social media, our Instagram and our Facebook for She Goes By Jane, and following, liking, commenting, sharing as much as possible. We really could use a little more visibility. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to get seen right now on social media. And I would love it so much if some of you would do that for us. So please, please get out there, get on our socials, like, share, comment if you can. We would appreciate it.
I agree. And as a reminder, you know, one of the things is like, obviously we want to grow She Goes By Jane in our profile so that we can keep doing mm-hmm. this work. But also, you know, every time you're sharing out those stories and sharing our podcast, I often believe that it's just really sometimes the case of getting the story in front of the right person for cases to be solved. Like either someone will recognize someone, that's obviously ideal, but also other people to get invested in the women that we're talking about.
Exactly. So,
And today's story is actually a great example of that, and it will become abundantly clear by the end. But I'll make sure to circle back about like how people can kind of advocate for this particular woman.
Sounds good.
Now, Vanessa, I messaged you immediately when I saw this, but our story begins with a mushroom hunter.
We always love the mushroom hunters. We love starting with a mushroom hunter or a good boy or girl.
Yeah, there's no dogs.
There's no dogs, no in, dogs this in this one. So after the last time, remember we had that little like discussion, like what is a mushroom hunter called? Are they mushroom hunters? Are they foragers?
Yes. What's the accurate
terminology? So since then I found out. So you can be like a mushroom hunter or a forager. Some people simply call it mushrooming. I'm going mushrooming later.
Okay.
Which I like. Mm-hmm. It's good and strong. But then there are also the mycophagists. I think I'm saying that right. And that is the actual name for people who collect mushrooms for consumption.
Oh.
Mycophagists.
Okay.
Yeah. So well, I'm always learning something new.
I'm guessing our guy who was out mushroom hunting in 1950 was maybe not calling himself a mycophagist.
Right.
But yeah.
He was probably calling himself a hunter or a forager.
Yeah.
He was probably also not mushrooming at that time, but I think that's my favorite one.
Mushrooming?
Mushrooming.
It sounds cute and cozy.
It's cute. It's cozy. It's simple.
Okay. But this is not cute and cozy. Now, as a reminder, people who are often in the outdoors, hunters, mushroomers.
Mm-hmm. Dog walkers. Yeah.
One of the reasons they are actually often the people who find unidentified people or people who are victims or, well, basically bodies out there is, you know, they are just in the right place. And that's true for this guy. So we're going to Wednesday, May 10th, 1950, and it's around 4:30 p.m. when a man named Benjamin Mills was out hunting mushrooms. Though it's late in the afternoon, there's plenty of daylight left as he's walking along Route 522 on the West Virginia side of the Potomac River. Now, to kind of help situate us in where we are, this road today provides a vital link in this corner of West Virginia into Maryland. But back in 1950s, reporting on this case said that it was like frequently referred to as a little used road or a lover's lane, meaning, you know, a quiet road where lovers would meet for privacy. So this is not at the time like a really heavily traveled road, according to these 1950s news reports. So Benjamin's out there and he's scanning the woods for mushrooms. You know, the late afternoon sun glistens off of some red hair in the grass, and this catches Benjamin's attention. So Benjamin scrambles down to investigate, and this is not an easy feat because he had to get down about 200 feet from the main road and down an embankment. That's where he learned that what he was actually seeing was the body of a woman. She's naked and curled up near a railroad culvert. It's clear abundantly that she is no longer alive, and her facial features were hard to make out because she had been beaten pretty brutally. Benjamin immediately walks to the town of Hancock, walking across the bridge into Maryland, since this is actually the closest town. There he notified Police Chief Howard Murfin and Maryland State Troopers of what he'd seen. When they arrive on the scene, they found it just as Benjamin had described, and though they search the nearby area, they can't find any clothing or identification for this woman that was found in this location. Now, she's taken, her body is for examination, and several doctors are actually working to figure out who she was and what might have happened to her. Because as with any person who died unattended and without identification, we know that they're left with several tasks. One, who is she? Two, how did she die? And three, when did she die? Now, in answer to the first, who is she? They obviously have very few clues. They determine she's a white woman between the ages of 30 and 50. So again, we're seeing those.
That's a very wide range again.
Yep.
Yep.
And she's about 5'5 and around 130 pounds. Though there is damage to her facial features, one of the prevailing narratives about her is that she's quite attractive. Like, every newspaper article is talking about how attractive this woman is.
Kind of weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, other physical attributes of note is that her teeth are well cared for and she doesn't have extensive dental work. There is some done, like some fillings, and she's missing, I think, her molars, but otherwise, you know, not.
She has good teeth.
Yes. And her hair is short and red, and it looks like it's been recently permed into curls. Like, so she is a natural redhead, unlike me. And only about like 4% of the U.S. population actually has naturally red hair. Now, beyond that, she does have a few notable scars. One is kind of like a W-shaped scar on her forehead. So not like, it's not like a perfect W. It's not like someone like carved, you know.
For real?
No. Yeah. So it's not like that. It's like a kind of, it's just in a jagged kind of shape.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so it's not a curve.
No.
You're just like, okay.
I think the reporting on this is like a lot of people thought that
she had a W carved in her head.
Yeah.
So it's just a ragged scar.
It's a ragged scar. It's got some like up and down motions to it, right? And also, though, she has a Y-shaped scar on the outside of her right wrist that's about 3 inches long. This is more current, so it hasn't, you know, fully healed. And pretty notably, she has two abdominal scars. One that is now called a hysterectomy scar in the reporting, but was originally reported as a cesarean scar. And one that appears to be from an appendectomy. So those are all significant clues to help with identification, right?
Mm-hmm.
They next have to look at how she died. The evidence here seems quite clear. Though no murder weapon was found near her body, she has very livid bruising around her neck, indicating that she was strangled with some type of rope. Like, this is quite deep, so deep that initially they thought she might have been stabbed.
Oh.
Yeah. And so the bruising, the marks are very clear that it's like a rope or garrote of some sort that had been tied around her neck. Now, in addition, she also had fracturing to her skull, and it looks like she sustained at least 3 blows to the head, and her neck is fractured. Their analysis leads them to believe that this could have happened as someone maybe threw her body from a moving vehicle or when she was rolled down the embankment. I'm not sure why they didn't also throw out there that the neck fracture could have happened in the, like, strangling, but this was their theories.
Right. So are they just putting the neck fracture just, is that the only injury they're putting to being thrown out? Like, yes. none of the other ones. Yeah. Okay.
And like I said, her facial features, they do appear to be swollen due to being beaten about the face, but this, according to examiners, appeared to be more of an attempt to conceal her identity. I don't know why they came to that conclusion. Or two happened during whatever attack she had experienced.
Is it typical for people to do that? To try to, like, conceal someone's identity by beating them?
I don't know. Why?
I don't know if I've ever heard of that.
Yeah, this is, like, also, like, sometimes, like, going through, like, 1950s procedures and approaches to crimes.
Like, but I'm wondering if it was, like, a thing. Like, you know how, like, sometimes we talk about something that seems off the wall, like amnesia.
Right.
And then it's because we found out that at that time there was like one story that included this.
Right. And so it gets carried through. So
yeah.
I'm not sure. Now, the coroner, C.C. Deich, he hastily assembles a jury. Basically, this was often done where the jury would weigh in on the cause of death. And they determined, after all the evidence was submitted, that she was murdered by strangulation by person or persons unknown. And then, you know, what's left is, when did she die? Like, this is crucial because it would help them figure out a timeline. Unfortunately, there was not a lot of consensus between the two physicians who examined her body. Now, she's found on a Wednesday, and one examiner believes she died about 3 days before, which would have placed her time of death on, say, Sunday or Monday. Another said that he thought she died about a day and a half before she was found, which would have been, you know, closer to a Tuesday when she was murdered. Now, compiling those details and clues is a start, but it doesn't get them any closer to figuring out who she is. The news of the discovery of her body hits the papers pretty quickly, but there aren't any, like, initial bites in terms of identifying her. Like, there aren't By which I mean, there aren't missing persons reported from the area. So it's clear right away that this might not be solved super quickly.
Well, it seems pretty distinct, too, with the short red hair. Like, if somebody was missing, it seems like it would have been really easy to put two and two together. But right. I guess if nobody's reported missing.
Yeah. So there's not like a...
Right?
Yeah. Now, investigators take two tactics initially. So first, her fingerprints are sent to just about every police agency they can think of, even those beyond the tri-state area, in the hopes they'd be compared to missing person reports or police records. These are sent along with detailed information about the woman. They also did send this to the FBI, hoping they might have some leads themselves. Now, while they're waiting for anything to come from that, her body is moved to the Newton D. Baker Veterans Administration Center near Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Whew. That's a name.
Yes. Now, this is where her body is stored in a refrigerated locker. And during her time there, her body is actually removed from refrigeration for viewing by the public. So In the 2 weeks her body is on display, nearly 2,000 people come to look at her.
Is this normal? Is this because she's unidentified? What is going on here?
Right, because...
Why?
Why? 2,000 people, right?
Why?
Okay, so something like this doesn't typically happen today, and that's because we have different ways and means of sharing details and images that wouldn't involve people driving miles and miles to view a body, right? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't necessarily unusual in the past. Like, we did coverage of the victims of the Cleveland Torso murders in one of our episodes, and in those cases you actually had victims on display for identification whose body parts had been severed. So like, that would have been quite a gruesome experience. So people were coming in and viewing like just heads.
Ugh. So they're really just trying to identify her through viewing her?
Yes.
And 2,000 people think that they might...
Well, no, because there's also
just taking a looky-loo.
We're taking a looky-loo, too. So, like, locally to us, like, for example, we're in upstate New York, and we actually had a local woman named Peggy Facto, this is historically, who was accused and convicted of murdering her newborn, and she was hung for this crime. And that execution drew crowds from across the region and nearby states to, like, come and watch the execution. But after her death, her body was put on display for...
Big air quotes?
Yes, this is big air quotes.
Okay.
Scientific reasons. And so many men came and wanted to, like, touch her body or view her body.
But this was not for science. This was because they're pervy.
Right. And so they actually had to decide, like, we're not going to display female bodies in our town like that again. So, yes, yeah, so there are a lot of people who are just coming because it's like... They're curious.
No.
No.
We won't do that.
No. Like, it's off the table.
Let's stop. Right?
Yeah. So the prevailing hope, I guess, by investigators is that, you know, she'll be identified through this. Like, there's all these people are going to come in and maybe someone will be like, oh, that's so-and-so. Mm-hmm. Now, there's one moment that feels like it could be something. And that's when a woman who's described as being poorly dressed told a worker at the Veterans Center that the unidentified woman was her sister and they couldn't afford to bury her. And that's why they'd left her on the side of the road.
Wait, what? But that doesn't answer anything else.
No.
So did they beat her before they left her on the side of the road and then they couldn't afford to bury the woman that just beat to death? Like, what sense does that make?
Yeah, so there's like a lot of problems with this. Namely, like, the worker tells this after the fact and apparently made no attempt to, like, get this woman's information. Which, I mean, the sole reason this Jane Doe is at this Veterans Center is for identification purposes. So Where was the failure there? But also, too, like, the details this woman is giving, like, don't actually match up with what investigators know.
That's such a weird thing to try to claim.
Yes. So, you know, okay, so 2,000 people come and view her body. No one recognizes her. And this leads investigators to believe that she's actually maybe not from the area at all. There's also the detail about her being her body being kind of curled up, right? Now, this isn't released in the early news reports, which indicate they might have been keeping that information to themselves, the positioning of her body. Mm-hmm. But later they'll say it seems like maybe her body was in that position for a while, and those working the case said it might be because she was hidden in something like a car trunk before she was left on the side of the road. This also helped lead them in the direction that she might have been transported from some distance. So those are their pieces of evidence that she might not be local. Now, on May 11th, which is one day after she's found, the first suspect in the woman's death is brought in. As a reminder, she's, you know, found on the 10th, so...
Yeah, how did we do that quickly? Are you going to tell me?
I mean, I don't know. This case is fascinating in how many suspects and how many women are thought to be this woman.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So just...
Yeah. So number one...
Okay.
...is this man named Frank Barnhart. He's a construction worker on a flood control project, and he's away for his work. And he has a wife who was last seen in Pittsburgh, and apparently she's missing. So they bring Frank in right away, but one... discrepancy is that his wife had a full dental plate, and again, Jane Doe has all of her teeth. So,
his wife.
No, they bring him to view her body, and like it's clear that she's not a match. On May 12th, two other leads and possibilities pop up for two different women. The first is a woman named Bernice Franklin. She was a waitress and a divorced mom. But most importantly, for this story at least, is that Bernice had been dating a man named Attilio Accolati. Accolati was involved in a gambling ring that the U.S. government was really pushing to crack down on. And Bernice, after an argument with Accolati, actually becomes one of the key witnesses for the government in the case. So she was like, I'm going to turn in my boyfriend, right?
Oh, so she's not even missing.
Well, she is. She's going to go missing.
Oh, whoa. Okay.
Yeah. So this is where she starts out. So she's out there. She's decided to be a witness in this, like, major gambling case, right?
Okay.
And Accolati himself, he's actually in jail because he's threatened Bernice in the past.
Okay.
And then Bernice goes missing in February of 1950. So there's a gap between her disappearance and the date Jane Doe was found, but some wondered maybe like Bernice had been kept somewhere first. So we have Bernice is missing. The second missing woman is a woman named Haley Mae Cobb, who was 33 years old and a mother of six, who had been reported kidnapped from Waldorf, Maryland, about 6 days before the woman was found. Now, for Bernice, at least, she's the witness in the gambling trial. Apparently, she had just wandered off. She wasn't missing at all. She just said like peace out to this. She didn't want to be involved in the trial anymore. Yeah.
So she just, yeah, she's gone.
Yeah. She was just tired of being involved. And Haley Mae Cobb, she actually wasn't kidnapped at all. She was just hooking up with the man her husband claimed had kidnapped her.
Okay. So they're both alive and well.
Yes, they're fine. Right. So Not either of them.
No.
We'll be back in a moment. On May 13th, there's another promising lead. This one gets a bit more complex, so you have to stick with me. Okay.
Okay,
so first, there's a man named T.C. Yost who picked up a female hitchhiker who rode with him 40 miles from Duncansville to Breezewood, Pennsylvania. This happened about 26 hours before Morgan County Jane Doe's body was found. So this works with one of the doctors who was correct about the time of death, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, T.C. offers a few different stories, or at least a few different ones were printed in the paper, but what I can parse out is that the woman was exceptionally chatty during their drive together and chain smoked and talked the entire ride. And apparently the woman said her name was Betty Lou and she lived on a farm outside Akron, Ohio. She said that she was leaving her husband and that she was on her way to meet up with a truck driver who she was meeting once TC dropped her off.
Okay.
Okay.
So she's chatty. She smokes.
Her name's Betty Lou.
Her name's Betty Lou. And he drops her off so she can meet A truck driver.
A truck driver, yes. Yeah. So TC says, when she left his car, she was limping slightly, which seems like a small detail, but investigators thought it was a solid clue. One of the key details about Jane Doe that they hadn't really shared was that there was a large blister on her right heel. Like, could that have been what caused this woman to limp? Could they be the same person?
Possibly, right?
Now, this hitchhiker story is quickly linked to a missing woman from Barberton, Ohio. She's named Mrs. Ursel Elizabeth Russell. So, you know, not Betty Lou.
Not Betty Lou.
But they're like, that must be. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about Mrs. Ursel Elizabeth Russell. On December 19th, 1948, so close to a year and a half before Jane Doe was found, Mrs. Russell had left her sister's home in Barberton, Ohio, to drive to her parents' farm in Canaan. Now, she never makes it. Her car is found 2 days later, parked near the Tuscarawas River.
Good name.
Yeah. Outside Canal Fulton. Her purse was found on the ground. She's nowhere to be found. So I'm not sure why this felt like a strong lead, but the papers are practically rabid about it.
So they're definitely thinking like Mrs. Russell and Betty
Lou
are one and the same.
Yes.
Maybe so, because Elizabeth, Betty.
Betty, maybe.
I don't know.
Like, so, yeah.
But I'm guessing you're going to tell me she's not.
Well, okay. So they start putting this story together. Like, obviously, Mrs. Russell was the hitchhiker that mm-hmm. T.C. Yost picked up. And then, obviously, she was also the murder victim.
Mm-hmm.
So, eventually they decide that Jane Doe could not be Ursel, because Ursel was just 5'2", and Jane Doe was about 5'5".
Okay.
Now, when they decide it wasn't Ursel, for some reason, they also seem to drop their whole line of inquiry about the hitchhiker at the same time.
Really?
Yeah.
So, because we ruled out Ursel,
mm-hmm.
we are going to rule out Betty Lou.
Yes.
Instead of considering that they're two different people.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Now, the sheriff says, you know, additionally, to him, it doesn't make sense because TC says he picked up Betty Lou about 26 hours before Jane Doe was found. The sheriff was leaning heavily towards her murder happening on that Sunday or Monday and not the Tuesday. So siding with the other doctor who was placing the time of death as three
longer-ish
days.
Okay.
Right? Now, Ursel, by the way, is still missing, though she is not in any databases.
Wait, you mean right now?
Mm-hmm. Ursel's never found.
So we've never inquired into Betty Lou ever again, and Ursel has not been found, and she's not in any databases.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. You know, I think this goes back to kind of something that always, like, rests in my mind when, particularly when an unidentified body is found and someone thinks it's like someone, so they'll be like, oh, this is that Jane Doe must be Sandy Smith. I'm just making these names up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when they find out that it's not Sandy Smith, they're like, oh,
okay.
I don't care.
Nothing more?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are there steps people can take or should take to get people like yourself back on a database or on a database at all, I guess?
So this would be, require the police who handled Ursel's case to submit her case to the database.
That's all it takes?
Yes.
Just the police station, like, kind of where she was found,
mm-hmm.
just submitting it to a database.
Yeah. So they have to go through some steps, but...
Well, right. I'm sure it's a lot of paperwork, and I'm sure it's, like, it could possibly be time-consuming.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
But are there, like, secretaries and stuff at the police station?
Well, I mean, I think
do stuff like this?
I find it interesting. And, you know, Ursel was written about as recently as a year ago in newspapers. And they spoke to police about it. But it's just, like, taking that extra step. And that's actually why we talk about, like, NamUs is a great database. I'm so glad that we have it. On the other hand, it's an incomplete database. And Ursel is one of those women who just... Or individuals, because there's men and non-binary people too, who just, like, never make it into databases. So Ursel is one of them.
Hmm.
So this is, like, where we, again, like, advocacy is
right.
Now, next, so we're moving on from Ursel slash Betty Lou, because they've just been like, nope, not to either. Next, they arrest a man named Fred Jackson Tharp. Now, Fred is described as an itinerant painter and an army deserter. So they're really not looking too fondly on him during this arrest. Now, during this arrest, they seize his belongings and they find that he has on him a woman's scarf, love letters from women, and most disturbingly to the 1950s mindset, a photo album containing 100 photographs of women.
Okay.
And now if you're about to ask me why they would find it disturbing, it's because they were described as pornographic.
Okay. So he's obviously a killer.
Right. Now, there are some other things that make them consider him as suspect. So it's not just the photo album. One is the key pieces of evidence is they find a long red hair on his coat, and they felt this might be a match to Jane Doe, which, side note, is strange because Jane Doe had short hair and this was described as a long hair.
I mean, she could have cut it at some point.
Right.
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. Now, so for the record, when they ask him about this, he's like, I don't know where that hair came from. The thing is, like, Fred also has another problem, and that's that in his car, they find a map with a route on it that goes through Millville, New Jersey to Hancock, Maryland, and on to Morgantown, West Virginia. So he was obviously driving through the area.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge problem in this for Fred, and that's that on the Friday night before Jane Doe was found, a teenager named Lorraine Hess was strangled in the town of Millville. So the very town that is circled on Fred's map. So Millville.
And another strangling.
Exactly. A few days later.
Not good. Okay.
They also found a neighbor who claimed that Fred told them that he had actually seen Jane Doe's body a full 30 hours before she was discovered. Yet Fred didn't report this to police. The Elkins Police Department that had Fred in custody said, "We haven't determined anything yet. He hasn't admitted to anything and has even recanted several statements that he gave us earlier. It all boils down to whether he's lying, and we hope to determine that sometime today."
Okay. So, why would he lie and say he saw the body before it was discovered? Why
would in that case, that's a neighbor saying that this is what Fred told them.
So it's like hearsay at this point? Yeah. We don't know if Fred actually said that?
I don't know. Like,
why would you do that, Fred?
No. Or maybe Fred's just trying to, like, have conversation. I don't know.
It's weird.
People do a lot of weird things, right?
So Fred might not be a murderer, but he's a weirdo.
Right. Now, on May 18th, Fred is given a lie detector test, and they question him in Lorraine Hess's murder and in the murder of Jane Doe. And even though the lie detector tests were already panned at this time as unreliable, and I can't say this enough, I've been deeply listening to a book on lie detector tests, but like even in the 1950s, there were questions about their validity, but law enforcement was using them regularly. So,
I mean, still, right?
We still do, right? Whether what's admissible in a court of law is different, but yeah, they're used globally, and the science behind it doesn't stand. But in this case, Fred passes the lie detector test, and so they let him go shortly after.
Just based on that. So, I mean, could he have done it?
I mean,
we still don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, in the midst of Fred's arrest, they announced that they have identified a woman. She's a waitress from Washington, D.C.
Which woman?
Jane Doe.
But this is an unidentified case.
Yeah.
Okay. So they didn't.
No.
Oh, okay.
So this time it's a coworker who claims this woman is Ida Sheath. The lead falls apart when they determine that their fingerprints don't match.
Is Ida missing still?
I could not find or track down information about Ida. So if anyone knows what happened to Ida.
Ida Sheath.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, are you getting tired of all the suspects?
I mean, there's a lot. Like, I don't know if I'm getting tired of it, but I'm certainly not keeping track of all of them.
No. And I think that's just going to continue. It just keeps rolling, right? Like,
okay.
And I think that this makes the case a little hard to sort through or make sense of, right?
Like, right.
So really, like, if you're looking at the dates of these, you really have, like, a one-week period in which it's clear they're just trying to wrap this up.
All this happened in 1 week?
Yes.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, a few other clues do pop up. One is that they find a dress alongside the road. several miles away. It's variously described as gray, buff, or rust. Hmm. So who knows what its exact color was. Mm-hmm. But there's a grass stain on one sleeve and there's no identifying labels on it. And so they actually take this dress and they place it on Jane Doe.
On her.
And according to reports, it fits her perfectly. Right. Now, they also find a box 23 miles away alongside the road. And this contains two bras, a pair of black panties, and a blouse. And 4 miles away from her body, they find two slips. So investigators are implying all of these clothing items might be hers.
That's a lot of clothing.
Right.
Is it like a suitcase that opened?
No, it's like in a box. Some of them.
The box. Okay, so. Wait, okay, I missed that part. So you said they found a box.
With some bras.
That had the bras. And the
black lace panties and a blouse.
But then they find, in a different spot, two slips.
And then in a different spot, a dress.
The dress.
Right, so they're implying, like, all these belong to this woman.
Okay.
Now, there's also an issue of a car that's been abandoned alongside the roadside, not too far from where the dress was found. It's an older sedan with Pennsylvania plates, and inside there's a 3-foot length of rope in the glove compartment.
Okay.
And they said that they found strands of hair on the rope. So is it possible that this is the murder weapon?
So are we actually getting into, like, closer stuff that has been kept as possibilities? You don't know.
I don't even know
at the clothes or the car.
The clothes. No. Mm. Now, okay. They determine the car was stolen over the weekend, and the timeline matches up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Plus, they have an escaped convict in the area who loves to steal cars.
Okay.
Like, could he have escaped prison, stolen the car, kidnapped a woman, murdered her, and then just been on his way again? Right.
I mean, I guess, right?
Right.
Could he?
Right. But then they look at the strands of hair and they determine they're not a match for Jane Doe. So they, I know.
What are you doing here, Amy?
I don't know. Like, this case. Oh, okay. So the theory is abandoned once again.
Okay.
Okay. So the investigation does quiet down for a few weeks as no new leads or investigative angles really come to light. On May 23rd, Jane Doe's body is taken from the refrigerated storage and is brought to Greenwood Cemetery in Berkeley Springs. This cemetery is used for burials of poor and unhoused and unclaimed, so she's buried there with, like, a simple headstone. The service is led by Reverend T.W. Sunderland of the Methodist Church, and he says, "This is the most unusual funeral service at which it has ever been my duty to officiate for a human gone unknown, save to God alone, and in the absence of a single mourner. We can only pray that God will look with mercy on the victim and her bereaved family. If there's one hope that man's innate sense of justice will someday deal fairly with the perpetrator of so wretched a deed." Finally, at the end of June, they make a stunning announcement. I know you all be shocked. They have identified the woman.
But they really haven't, have they?
No.
Okay.
And potential suspects in her death. This time she is Lottie Wolf Gibson, a divorced mother of two from Akron, Ohio. This identification actually comes from several witnesses who are questioned by police in three states. So they're like, oh, we got it this time, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Lottie was the girlfriend of James Preston Bishop, who was known to police and wanted on several charges. Lottie was last seen on Sunday, May 7th, and James's at James's father's home near McConnellsburg, and several members of the Bishop family are questioned about Lottie's disappearance. Now, violence seems to be erupting in the Bishop family household around this time, because on June 17th, one of James's brothers, so James is the one Lottie is dating,
mm-hmm.
one of his brothers, Lester, was fatally shot by another brother, Walter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who's arrested like a day later for that crime.
That's awful.
Yeah. Now, the search for Lottie is pretty brief. She pops up very much alive 11 days later, likely wondering what the fuss is all about. She calls into police and then they have her come in to just like verify that she's okay.
I love how many of these women are actually still fine and well.
Yeah, they just like,
they're just wandering off somewhere. They need a breather.
Yeah. And then, you know, came back and was like, what the heck now? This is one of the last identifications of this woman before her, of Jane Doe, before her case really starts to fade from view. Like the following year, on the 1 year anniversary of the discovery of Jane Doe's body, the newspapers kind of take a dig at the investigation by saying she's now been identified 7 times. I actually, Vanessa, did not include all of them in here.
Seriously.
Yeah.
It feels like you gave us 7. Did you not? How many did you give us?
It felt like 40, to be honest.
Yeah.
Now, in that first year, though, like the state police, headed by Corporal Charles S. Burke, has devoted 900 hours to trying to solve this crime. He's answered over 402 letters and traveled to Akron, Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Cumberland, Maryland, D.C., and just like countless points in Virginia and West Virginia. He says of his motivation, "There's a murderer running loose in my territory, and I am determined to find out who he is." Now, he says, by 1954, so a full 4 years later, 3 different men on separate occasion have confessed to her murder, and none of them are viable confessions. So, despite the sheriff's dedication, Morgan County Jane Doe does go unidentified. This does seem pretty bleak. But Morgan County Jane Doe has not been forgotten. Her case, within the last 15 years, has been worked on by cold case investigators. One of them is a man named Swinger, who was in charge of going through all the old notes, photos, and evidence in her case. In 2013, he said, "We were fortunate enough that there were still reports there at Berkeley Springs. It would be possible that someone could still be alive that perpetrated the crime, but the main focus at that point was to try to identify her." So you see a shift, you know, so many years later, they're just more concerned with identifying her.
Which is nice.
Yeah. He continued by saying there were literally thousands of hours put into that case to still not know who she is. Someone out there is looking for their loved one. And that's what motivated me to work on the case.
It's funny because, like, right all along, it does seem like they were really trying to find out who this woman is. But it's just like all those other people getting, like, popping up and wasting their time constantly. So even when they're trying to do the right thing, it doesn't go smoothly every time.
Yeah. I mean, you have to imagine, like, if you were back in, like, 1950 and seeing this, and, like, every day you picked up the paper and it's like, someone else.
Yeah.
Something else.
Today it's this woman. Tomorrow it's that woman.
Yeah. Like, I can't imagine that really gave anyone in that area, like, much confidence in the police, in their work on it, right? Now, again, this does seem pretty bleak because she has yet to be identified. But in 2007, so going back a little bit even further, an important development did happen in her case. And that's that in that year, 2 different families came forward asking if it was possible that this woman could be their missing loved one. So just kind of collision of time, like 2 different family groups who are like, maybe she's ours, right? And this actually led to the exhumation of her body, allowing them to take DNA samples. Like, these were compared against the families, and they were determined not to be a match. But it does mean that the woman's DNA is on record, making it easier to move forward with an investigative genetic genealogy solve using the tools that we do have available today. Now, in my digging, I didn't see that her case has been taken on by any investigative genetic genealogists, but I hope they do, so that, like other women, she can have her name back.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, West Virginia Pastoral, Unidentified Woman Discovered May 10th, 1950 in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. This land could be its own kingdom. A flash of red hair snagged in the grass its seagull. The steady hum of water rushing through culverts its battle cry. Here, our women don't read palms or craft destinies from bones that rattle from their bags. Imagine gravity skimming from the earth, our bodies losing hold of the surface, our knives slipping from our hands. Imagine how we could teach our daughters the magnetic pull of a new land's lines instead of how push the right pieces of a car trunk to escape.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No.